Shares. Market. The S&P. The ASX. Stocks. This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, like the postman, always knocks twice. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me as always is Anir Barn, Doc Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Captain. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, we're coming to you from last week, believe it or not. We're actually recording this the week before you'll hear it, because, Doc, you'll be away and I'll be away. So yes. We don't want to leave our listeners without some Motley Fool goodness this week. So we're going to dip into the Motley Fool mailbag. We have a bumper mailbag this week. We've got some good questions, some good comments that we're going to get your thoughts on, Doc, and I'll add some of my thoughts because, frankly, I'm an opinionated bastard and I like to do those sort of things, so I will. And we'll be back with you next week live with some other good stuff. In fact, we've got a special guest next week, so stay tuned and you'll be able to hear that. But for this week, Doc, we're going to start with a few questions. Now, we've got one question from Rick from Adelaide. And Rick says, "Hi, fools, love the podcast, listen every week." Thank you, Rick. We appreciate your kind words. He's got a question about short-term investing, mate. He says, "We have sold our family home and are renting for 1 to 2 years and saving for a larger deposit. I want to invest our savings in the interim to maximize the return whilst ensuring there is no chance of a loss. What would you guys suggest? Perhaps an ETF or a combination of ETFs?" Now, the first thing we should say, as always, is this show only gives general advice. We can't give personal advice, Rick, so we can't tell you what's right for your situation. But broadly, Doc, for a member, a listener, a reader who asked us that sort of question, so again, he's going to rent for 1 to 2 years and save for a larger deposit, and he wants to invest in the interim to maximize the return while ensuring there is no chance of loss. Is an ETF the right solution?
Thanks, Rick, for the question. We love your questions. I would say in this case, investing the money in the market is probably the wrong thing to do.
Aren't we a share investing mob?
Oh, we are, but you know.
But there's going to be an ETF somewhere for it, surely.
So there might be an ETF somewhere that, you know, that allows you have some bond return, bond-like returns or something like that. But that, you know, some esoteric, something esoteric that gives you like a term deposit-like return. But
kind of seems to defeat the purpose.
Yes, it defeats the purpose, I think. We talked about this a little bit last week,
we
right?
Did.
And I think the same answer holds. If you need the money in the next, let's say 3 years, that's how I invest. Any money that I need in the next 3 years, I would not put in the market.
Hang on, you're almost fully invested in shares. Why would you not be in the market? Is the market going to crash the next 2 years? Is that what you're thinking?
The market could crash anytime.
So hang on, will or it could? What are you saying here?
It could. Okay. I don't know when it'll crash. If I knew when it will crash, then it would be fantastic.
You'd sell everything, right?
I would sell exactly 1 second before it crashes.
And then buy at the bottom and make a fortune.
Well, and buy at the bottom and make a fortune.
Easy. So, how hard's that?
If that was possible, I don't know where I would be. I'd be in Mars, maybe.
All right. So let's not send you to Mars just yet, dear. We want you here at home.
Yeah.
So let's say that Rick hasn't got the ultimate crystal ball and can't see that.
Yeah.
Your point is that we just don't know when the next crash is coming?
Yeah, because we don't know where the crash is coming. And I think, you know, he's saving for a bigger house and this is a deposit for the house.
Right.
I wouldn't tell anyone to do is don't put your deposit for your house that you're looking to buy in the next couple of years in the market in a way that, you know, if the market drops by 20%, you know, the market does fall, like, you know, about 9-10% every 1 in 3 years or so.
Right.
And maybe you find a dream house and at that time the market has, you know, taken a drop.
Yeah.
In which case then you wouldn't be able to buy that dream house. So given that you have a specific purchase that you want to make, I wouldn't put that money into the market. That's what I would do. You know, again, he should talk to an advisor,
financial advisor, for
advice. But yeah, that would be my take.
I think it's very sound. I tend to agree. I have to say, I think as you rightly point out, the market does fall. Well, here's the thing about averages, right? Averages are averages by definition, but it doesn't mean it works like clockwork. So the market falls on average 10%. About once every 3 years, but it could go 6 years and then fall 20% on 1 year, or exactly. It could fall 10% 2 years in a row. There is nothing about the history of the market that suggests there is any way you can, despite what the chart readers would say, pull a pattern out of investing and try and work out where shares are likely to go next. You simply can't know. We know the long-term returns are very good. We have reason to believe that the basis for those returns, the very kind of harnessing of what I like to call democratic capitalism, the human desire to improve things, is going to continue to grow and create value over the medium and long term.
Yeah.
But 1 to 2 years is just way, way, way too short. If you'd sold the house, Rick, in 2007 and then woken up 2 years later, your money, you probably lost a third of your money.
Yeah.
And you know what? Right then, if you're going to say, well, geez, I want to buy a house, you've either got to buy a house that's effectively a third less, or you've got to basically say, well, I can't do it yet. And neither of those is necessarily great options.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got more time, if the 1 to 2 years is reasonably locked in, then Doc's advice is absolutely spot on. I've said to friends in the past, and again, I don't give them personal advice, but I give them general advice, that if they're looking at, you know, if the time is flexible, if they can buy any time between the next 2 and 5 years, for example,
yeah,
then, you know, it doesn't really matter when you buy, then you can kind of start to make some different choices. And if you're prepared to say, well, I'll invest in shares, and if the market falls in 2 years' time, we'll simply put off our purchase until the market recovers, then you've got some different options available to you. But if your time frame is limited or relatively limited, and you don't have that absolute flexibility on time frame, then your money shouldn't be in the market, as Doc's already said, for any 3 years. I would even say if it's a house deposit, if it's literally you need the absolute capital, I'd even go out to 5 years. Basically, if you want, as you say, no chance of loss, then frankly, I mean, there is nothing like that, right? There is no possible investment that has no chance of loss, but you want to minimize as much as you can the chance of loss. If that's absolutely your approach, then frankly, cash in the bank, term deposits with a government-guaranteed financial institution. So think about our major or even our regional banks. If the government's backing it, I mean, the government could always go broke, but those are so remote as to be effectively impossible. But they're still, it's not totally impossible. So we never want to say anything is completely risk-free. There is no such thing. But to the extent that you want to minimize to the absolute minimum your chance of loss, then a government guaranteed term deposit, as boring as it sounds, and frankly, as low return as it will be, is absolutely your best place to be if your number one objective is, firstly, no loss, and then secondly, on top of that, how do I maximize my return? Go for the best possible term deposit you can have over your chosen time frame with a government guaranteed bank. Anything else to add on that one, Doc?
No, I think it sounds very sound.
Very good. Oh, it's always, I like when you agree with me, mate. Doesn't happen very often, but when it happens, I like to highlight it because it's important.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
We got a tweet during the week from Sam Evans. Now, I'm a bit of a prolific tweeter, Doc, as some of our listeners may know. You can get me at TMFScottP. The Motley Fool, Scott Phillips, so TMF Scott P, not very imaginative. Where can they get you on Twitter, Doc?
I'm just at Anirban Mahanti.
Oh, see, that's the advantage of, Scott Phillips wasn't available. I couldn't get any of the Scott Phillipses. I had to go with something a bit different. Mm. Anirban Mahanti. All right, so that's as it sounds, but I will spell it for our listeners: Anirban Mahanti. Anirban Mahanti. So you can get us both there, and Sam did. Now, I tweeted during the week, and I said, so firstly, there was a tweet. Stick with this while I describe this. So Peter Fitzsimons, the ex-Wallaby and sports writer, I like this. So he's finding some old Australian expressions, and he says, I was chatting to a lovely old bloke from up Moree Way. He pointed out the old scientist on the other side of the room he just chatted to, and he said, he could give you the square root of a jam jar and not know how to get the lid off. And I thought that was kind of cool, right? That kind of idea that he knows all of the stuff but can't quite make it work. Now, as true or untrue as that might be, as apocryphal as the story might sound, I then followed that up because it really rung a bell for me, Doc, when it comes to investors. And I said, this describes way too many investors, too smart for their own good. It makes them favor action and intellect over what actually works. Trying so hard to be intellectually right and clever, they somehow struggle to find out and do what works. Now, Sam says, maybe you could discuss this on your podcast, so I will. He said next week's high horse, but I'm gonna save that because I want a different one. He said, I can't understand why so many investors focus on quant, in other words, numbers, rather than qualitative analysis. Investing is more of an art than maths, but this isn't taught at university. Now, I think I wouldn't say more an art than maths. I'd probably say equal parts art and science if it was my choice, but I won't quibble with Sam. He's made a good point. I'm going to quickly just give a bit of a thought, and I want to get your thoughts, Doc, as to how you approach it. I want to try and put that, my kind of tweet, in context. There's we kind of know from the greats before us of different genres and styles, everywhere from David Gardner, who I know is a big influence on you, Doc, one of the best growth investors either of us have ever seen. I'm a big Warren Buffett fan. I admire David Gardner and his brother Tom, as we both do. So, you know, there's some great investors that we've been able to learn from and basically come imitate, right? There's no points for originality in investing. Imitating the greats is the best possible way to put the odds in your favor. And we kind of know that as a result, things like buying and holding, not trading too frequently, not trying to be too clever, finding great long-term investments, not worry about the short-term volatility, all that stuff we kind of know, right? And then I see time after time after time, otherwise smart people who get so caught up in the intellectual exercise of trying to work out what might happen in the short term with this or that or the other. And they make all these trades and kind of, they're so caught up in the intellectual thing. Our kind of part colleague, former colleague, Joe Mager, who now runs Lakehouse Capital, introduced me to the quote, you know, do you want to be right or do you want to make money? Mm. And it's kind of that sense you can spend so long trying to be intellectually clever and try and think through all of these ridiculously detailed theories and analyses and you buy this and buy that and sell this and sell that. Mm. Or you can kind of just buy good stuff and wait. And that's the bit that gets me. So many investors who frankly do know better and should know better, but kind of can't help themselves because they're so busy trying to be smart, they somehow forget to let the kind of old rules work and make them some money.
This is a fantastic, I love this because investing to me is definitely part art, part science.
Now you're a scientist by background, so give me your perspective on this.
Yeah, so I'm a scientist by background, but you know what I used to do is computer performance modeling, and the best book on that subject.
I don't even understand the term, let alone what you do, but so try me anyway.
It's relatively simple. So you take any complex system, like say the internet or you know something on the internet, and you develop a model for it.
Right. Okay.
And you try to understand the system.
Okay.
Right. And you find bottlenecks and you try to improve the bottlenecks.
That's why you're the PhD, by the way, and I'm the lowly bachelor. But keep going.
Yeah. So the best book on that subject had a beautiful title. It was called The Art and Science of Computer Performance Modeling.
Hey, nice. All
and
right.
Art was put first.
That is
brilliant.
I reckon that would surprise almost everybody listening. How is that received in the scientific community?
It was one of the the most read books in that subject.
Wow, okay.
So I think there's something to that. And there's another quote I'll use. It's from a statistician called George Box.
George Box, okay.
Okay. And the quote is really nice. He says that all models are wrong.
Yeah.
Only some are useful.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And
see that, I'm going to say very quickly before I let you go on, most people listening who aren't scientists by trade would assume that scientists are kind of like mathematicians. They like rules and theories and kind of models and that's they kind of explain the world in a very logical, rational sense. Even old style classical economists, right? It's that sense of there's a model for everything. There's a structure and a process and a flow for everything. It doesn't require much art. So frankly, it surprises me, and I imagine it would surprise most of our listeners. Give us a look on the inside then. Why have we got the wrong impression? And more importantly, how are scientists incorporating art and science?
So I think the issue is that we look at things like physics, which have hard laws, right?
And gravity.
And gravity,
E equals MC squared.
Yeah, E equals MC squared.
That's all I know.
Newton's first law, second law, and so on and so forth, right?
There's a law of thermodynamics somewhere, but I couldn't tell what it is.
Of thermodynamics. All right, all right. So many different laws.
That's my entire scientific understanding
I think
in one
people have become used to the fact that there are certain, science means there should be laws.
Right.
Right. And that's not...
How things work.
How things work. And what many complex things involve human behavior, where I think, you can't really, box it into a particular model, right?
Okay.
So you make an assumption, right? So the rational human being assumption that economists make, right? It's not that economists don't know that's not true, but it's a good enough assumption to make to understand a system and to get some understanding about, what happens in a market, for example. A market is efficient if everybody is rational.
Right.
And then, of course, they'd realize that the market is not efficient because not everybody is rational. Right, but it's a good starting point to study something. So I think that's a very interesting point. But back to what you were talking about, people's desire to be overconfident or do quantitative things.
Over clever, I would say. Just that sense of kind of like it's almost the intellectual challenge that rather than do the easy things and do them well. Some people seem to prefer to do the hard things, maybe because it proves something to themselves. I don't know if it's ego or intellect or something, but it's kind of like. You do the easy things. Well, you mentioned compound interest or compounding in our last podcast. And some sense of if you just let compounding do its thing, you don't have to do much more, right? Like it's helpful to beat the market by a little bit because you're compounding larger numbers is obviously better. And we both try and beat the market. And so far, so good for both of our services. But there's so many people who lose to the market because they're trying to be too clever, right?
Exactly. And I think the thing is that people like action, right? So when you're trying to do, inaction is actually probably the best thing in the market, right? I mean, be slow. you don't have to always do something, because if you're always doing something, it can be counterproductive, because you're going to make many more decisions than you actually need to make, right? And I like this thing that, you know, David Gardner wrote a commentary many years ago, and he called it anti-confidence, if I'm not
right. Anti-confidence, okay. Tell me about that.
So what he's basically saying is that, you know, he tries never to be very confident. And what he does is he finds good companies, good ideas, you know, run by good leaders, you know, doing innovative things, right? Tries to find the lead husky. Mm. And he says, well, this is an investment. Let's make one. And then let it ride. Mm. You find another one and you make one and you let it ride. You don't try to second guess. You don't try to, you know, see if something is going on this quarter, this half, this year.
Right.
You let it ride. And over time, the best ideas will win, and they will win big. And he, you know, he will say that his portfolio becomes bigger because the winners, they increase many fold, and they become bigger by the definition that they were successful.
Right.
And the ones that were not successful become insignificant because you lose money on them. But it doesn't matter, because what matters is that we can lose at most 100% of our money in one position.
Mm-hmm.
But we can be up 10x, 100x. And he is up 100x on many investments, at least two now that I know of, Amazon and Netflix, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you get a couple of those, they will make up.
It's kind of all you need, right?
It's probably that's all you need. Yeah. And maybe that's enough to wipe out, you know, several of, you know, the bad ideas, right? So not doing anything and not trying to second guess. And along the way, for example, Amazon, you could have guessed, oh, they're going to fail here. They're going to fail there. They could fail here. Maybe eBay is going to kill them. Maybe Walmart is going to kill them. Right.
Hmm. I think there's a couple of things there. The first is, to your point, and this is something we try and look, you know, I used to have an old boss, Kristen Holgate, who was the CEO at Blackmores, and she used to say, even when you thought you've told people enough, you haven't, so keep telling them. And one of we'll say this a lot in this podcast over the next, well, hopefully years to come, and that is that when we think about portfolios, it's so, so important to think about your portfolio as a group of stocks collected together that give you an average return. If you are trying to avoid loss in every single company, A, we go back to kind of the original point from Rick about we might as well stay in cash. And then B, a failure of an individual investment is not a failure of your investment style. And to your point, Doc, you know, David Gardner would say he's had more failures than anyone in the company, I think, from his kind of favorite line. I'm not entirely sure if that's entirely true, but it's close enough to be, you know, worthwhile for our purposes. So more failures than anybody, but also the highest return of anybody at the company. And that's specifically because of that idea that he's kind of playing, he's investing according to his own system. And that system throws out some losers and it throws out some winners. And the winners win big in a much greater way than the losers lose. And so the maths of that is simply just very straightforward. You simply make more from your winners than you lose from your losers. And the result is you end up with more money overall. And he's done that just to such an extent that he's delivered a really strong result. I think there's some value there. And he's done it largely, as you say, mate, by buying companies and very, very rarely selling. I mean, I don't know the numbers. I'd say 80%+ of his recommendations ever for the last 15 or so years are still
buys.
Active recommendations?
Either buys or holds.
Right,
he's a reluctant seller.
Right.
He's a lot like Warren Buffett when it comes to, you know, holding companies for the long run.
I will happily throw my lot in with both of them. I hate selling because there's a whole lot of reasons why. We should probably do this a separate piece. But if you sell, you've got to buy something else. You've got to get two decisions right rather than just one.
Yep.
The chance that you might be wrong in the first place. Frankly, if you've done your research properly originally, you shouldn't need to sell. And again, if you do, there's every good chance that the stock goes on to be a market beater anyway, a la my Domino's story from last week, where I'm still staring in the barrel of giving up a three-bagger after making 100% feel like I was a genius. So I've learned from that in particular, frankly. I'm very, very, very reluctant to sell. And some of our biggest winners at Multifull Share Advisor in Australia too have been, we have one 10 bagger and an 8 or 9 bagger, a couple of 2 and 3s, basically from that lesson and from lessons from the gardeners and others of basics. And look, maybe it's overvalued, maybe it's not, but gee, if it's a good quality company run by good people you like, there's every chance it'll keep going and keep being successful.
Exactly. I love that.
I'll finish with one quick quote from the French philosopher Blaise Pascal, who says, "All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone." I think there's some lessons there for investors as well.
Beautiful quote. Love it.
Good, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, I'm going to go back to one of your, favorite topics. Mm. But it's your favorite topic kind of because you don't like the company. So I'm going to let you have your say, but then I'm going to wrap it up myself. So Samuel Krieg sent me a direct message and said, "Hey, I feel like you guys were very down on Telstra in a recent podcast. Just curious, has your sentiment changed after the investor presentation? I, like you, seem to have mistimed my entry point. Now, Doc, I don't imagine your view on Telstra's changed in the last week or so.
Okay. Okay. So this is for Samuel and anybody else who's a Telstra shareholder.
Oh, be kind. Be kind.
So I'll say this.
We like our listeners.
I love our listeners and we love our members.
We do.
And I'll say this. You know, I might sound negative on Telstra, but I don't mean that this company is going away or is disappearing.
This is one of these dead companies that isn't really dead.
It's one of those dead companies that's not really dead. I think it's Telstra is a good company to hold at a good price. It's a good company to hold for the dividends it's going to return to you.
Right.
You know, if you're looking for franking credits and dividends, and that's, you know, an important component of your portfolio, then it's a perfect fit for that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a growth investor, so I don't invest in companies that are paying me 6% dividends.
Yep.
But with respect to Telstra, I think what had happened is the market was starting to value Telstra as if it's like, you know, a growth company with significant growth. And I think that was where I think things went wrong. And maybe the market is now thinking Telstra is dead. It is not.
So, right.
So
well, you said it's dead, so it must be dead, right?
So okay, bear that in mind. The whole industry, telco, is very competitive.
Yep.
And you know, and I think both, you know, TPG and Telstra, they could both do well. Mm. I think the price matters. And right now the price is low. I think there's still there's still rough seas here, especially with what's going to happen. I think the main thing for me is what's going to happen with 5G.
Yeah.
And if something and if 5G becomes the major broadband provider, that could actually be a good thing for Telstra.
Yep.
Right. And it could reduce its dependence on NBN for broadband.
Well, they've got a pretty good lead in 5G, well, in 4G anyway. But there's every chance they'll be the leader in 5G.
Yeah.
TPG breathing down its neck. But to the extent that people kind of go mobile rather than NBN, because of the way the NBN pricing and margins go for Telstra and the other retailers, effectively resellers of the NBN, you're going to make more money having your own network than using the NBNs, right?
Exactly. And I think this is why I brought 5G up. I think eventually, you know, the NBN could be the big white elephant. I mean, it could be that we go completely mobile for everything. It would be easier for everybody. You can bundle your home broadband with your mobile smartphone plan.
And
it would be fantastic.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So I think Telstra's mobile advantage should not be written off, and I think there's a price at which the company is a good buy. I think it's probably getting there. It's been sold off a lot. So I'm you know, it's not a growth investor's thing, but for the value investor, for the person looking for income,
bit of tax effective income, nice franking credits.
Tax effective income. This is a good stock, maybe. Yeah. Look, that's my tip.
They're very conciliatory of you, Doc. I'm pleased to hear that. I will quote this. I will take this as a snippet and I'll put it on as my ringtone on my phone. I think
you're welcome.
Samuel's right to some degree. I did let you run away with your why I'm worried about Telstra thesis, and that's a validly held view. And I think what we like to do at the Motley Fool and on this podcast in particular is present different views where we have them. Generous, you know, kind of complete agreement is not much fun to listen to, and kind of, you know, it's the considering of different views that really makes the difference here. I think it's, you know, looking for encouraging the debate, it makes us all smarter and better investors. I will say to your point, Doc, and to Samuel's question, look, I was wrong about Telstra in the sense that I agree with you about 5G, Doc, and I had expected over time that the mobile business would grow quickly enough to offset the declining business in the fixed line. That was horribly wrong in hindsight. The share price tells us that story. They simply couldn't grow mobile as fast as I thought they could. I don't know it was necessarily a company problem. I think it's partly that. Probably partly, frankly, just an analysis mistake from me. So, you know, we make mistakes. We like to own up to them. That was a mistake from me. I should have thought more clearly and more cleverly, more intelligently about what was likely to happen. I missed that one entirely. That being said, I think that the theme is still the right one. I still expect that 5G will do well. I do agree with you, mate. I've always been for all the NBN stuff, and we get lots of people whinge about the NBN, and yes, the NBN's kind of crap, but more broadly, I think the government's right not to sink too much cash into it, because there's a very real possibility that the future is mobile rather than fixed line, at least to the same degree that they're investing in on a per household basis to provide it. If in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, a decent proportion of us are using mobile rather than fixed NBN. To your point, it becomes a white elephant, and any government, and this isn't a political comment, more a governance comment of whatever political stripe, would be best not to have spent $1 squillion on that, because if mobile is the future, then you know no point laying more railway tracks, right, when we're all flying to Mars. So there's some value there, I think. So yeah, look, for what it's worth, I think Telstra still is a buy. I think it's a market beater from here. It won't be a growth investment, as you say. I don't think it'll be necessarily one that will knock the socks off. I wouldn't be trying to find a 10-bagger investment with Telstra. But I do think if you're particularly a conservative investor, an income investor, as you say, Doc, or simply want to beat the market, I do expect Telstra to beat the market from here. But again, nothing is certain. So that's our view. Samuel, apologies for seeming a bit too downbeat on it last time. I'm still a fan. It's still a buy, but it's not exactly unchallenged. For what it's worth, I also do like TPG. And I think for my money, both those are active recommendations at Motley Fool Share Advisor. I like both companies. It's possible one will win or to some degree at the expense of the other. Not necessarily the other one will lose, but I think either of those or maybe both in some combination win the broadband war, or the mobile broadband war, I should say. So I like both. I think it's worth having both in a diversified portfolio.
I'll just add one thing. I think if there's a war and we think that there's going to be tough competition, I think what might be happening is the bigger players are going to squeeze the smaller ones.
Right.
Is my take. So I think these two companies can do well. Right. Even if you get a 1% beat over the market, that's pretty good with the dividend that you get and the franking credits that you get with Telstra. So totally. I'm not completely downbeat on Telstra, though. When I call it, it's dead. It's not really dead. Dead basically means that it's not
growing. The other dead.
Yeah, it's the other dead. It's not growing at 30% or 40%, and therefore it's not my kind of thing. But
Good man.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, now, mate, we talked about David Gardner a little bit already. I'm going to take a leaf out of David Gardner's book, and I've got a question here. The question comes from Scott P. of a company called TMF, and it sounds very familiar. I can't quite put my finger on it, but Scott P, it looks like a smart bloke. He's a handsome guy from the photo I can see here, devilishly handsome, very smart, thoughtful, a good sense of humour, a really lovely guy from the look of it. Anyway, he asks, Doc, why on earth do you love lower share prices? What is wrong with you that you don't cheer on higher prices? Every time I say, great, the market's up, you say, oh, that's a shame. And when I say, oh, mate, the market's down, you're like, yes, that's great. Why do you hate me? Why do you hate the fact that people make money from a rising market?
Man, I thought you're smart, but you're maybe not.
You're entitled to be wrong, at least on one of those two counts. Yeah, exactly. We'll let listeners decide which one you're wrong about.
Okay. So this is from the perspective of someone who hopes to invest, let's say, for another 20, 30, maybe longer, depending on how long I can live. I'm just being very greedy. And I'm saying that if somebody wants to invest, continue investing, then what do you really want, right? I mean, I want lower share prices because...
Yeah, mate, I can see a whole lot of crappy shares I've got that have fallen. You want those ones?
No, I don't want...
They've fallen.
I want great businesses at fantastic discounts. And I am happy to buy more of them as they become even more discounted.
But you're losing money, mate. If the share price was from $10 to $5... You've lost half your money.
It's great.
It's
fantastic because I don't need the money now. If I'm investing in money, I don't need the money now, and I'm happy for irrational selling to give me that jeans or whatever, the jeans equivalent company,
right?
At a discount. Who doesn't like to buy a jeans at half the price, right? If your favorite jeans are selling for half the price, wouldn't you buy it? So. If my favorite company is selling for half the price, I would buy it instantly. And, I know that over the long term, my company will deliver, or at least I believe that on average, the companies I own will deliver me good returns. And therefore, if I can buy them at a lower price, I will have a much higher chance of getting a much better return than I would if the share prices are going up.
But if the shares are going down, mate, obviously something's wrong with the company. Surely when the shares are down, it's time to sell. Not buy more.
Well, So
the falling share price got to mean that there's something wrong with the company, surely.
Yeah, surely. So when, one of my favorite companies, Apple shares, was selling
not Apple again.
For $10 10 years ago, something was definitely wrong with the company, right? Today the shares are at, 180
All right. Yeah, she made money at Apple. Fine.
So I don't know. I mean, shares go down for a reason. People do crazy things. The people do crazy things. The market does crazy things. people, remember, people are not rational.
And you're happy to buy from crazy people is what you're telling me.
I am perfectly happy to buy from crazy people who are, you know, if somebody's going to sell me my favorite company for half the price, I will take it.
Mate, you're not a Ben Graham fan necessarily. At least you don't follow, you don't invest like Ben Graham. But I think even you would be able to tell me the Ben Graham quote that goes along with the sometimes falling share prices.
Oh, so you're talking about the voting machine?
That's the one. Yeah. Give us the quick summary of that and how that kind of comes into play.
Right. Over the short term, the market is essentially a voting machine.
Mm-hmm.
But over the long term, it's a weighing machine.
Ah.
So I like the weighing machine aspect of the market.
So your point really isn't that you're not saying every time any share price goes in, you should buy more of that particular company.
No.
What you're saying is that if there's an opportunity to say buy a company's, if you get a company whose shares have fallen for whatever reason, as long as the future remains bright, and to your point about jeans, if they're crappy secondhand jeans with mud stains and blood all over them, you're not going to buy them just because they're half price.
Exactly.
But if they're really good quality jeans that happen to be half price because some shop somewhere is desperate to make its budget, and so it's selling off as much as it can for as cheap as it can.
Yeah. Or it's closing down. It's closing down.
Right.
It's closing down. You know, half, 30%, you know, it's all half price.
So, and the voting machine really comes down to the emotions of the market. So, you know, things like, the GFC, for example, great time. For as much as, you know, 2007, the market was riding high. 2008, 2009, everyone, the market's crashed. People are miserable. In hindsight, and even for those of us who kind of felt like it at the time, that was the time to be buying, not selling, right? So, as the market fell 40%, some people saying, the market's down, this is terrible, we're going to lose money. Others were saying, well, the businesses are still the same and the market's now offering them to me at half price. If I still like Commonwealth Bank or Woolies or Flight Centre or pick your company, then why wouldn't, if you liked the business 12 months ago at a higher price, why wouldn't you like it even more now? Because you can buy more shares for the same money, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll caveat this by saying that I do believe that, you know, for people who are retired, for example, and who are living off their portfolios, it hurts, and which is why we said, you know, you should, any money that you need over the near term, you shouldn't have in the stock market. But yeah, so I mean, if most of your nest egg is in the market and market falls, it's going to hurt. And you know, even our, you know, it's a mixed emotion when the market goes down. And I look at my portfolio, well, it looks red. I don't like it, but I like the fact that if I can invest some money this month, that's great. So, yeah.
All right, and then for an investor who's kind of, so let's answer the unasked question: what's the difference between one that goes down and stays down, and one that goes down and bounces back? So company A and company B both fall 25% tomorrow.
Hmm.
How do you go about working out which one is on a road to oblivion and which one's just in, you know, kind of sold off on some sort of market emotive kind of overreaction and is destined to come back?
In company specific scenarios, this is harder, right? But I mean, you know, the GFC is a good example. Well, if you have a financial crisis or some sort of emotion-driven collective market action where everything is selling for a discount, right? That's a good time to buy. It's hard to buy at those times because you think, like, you know, the whole market. I mean, this is the way I rationalize it. I said, well, if everything in the market is falling, and you're not able to buy, that basically means that you don't have any belief in the financial system, right? If you don't have any belief in the financial system, it does not matter where you keep your money.
right.
You can keep it in your bank, all the banks are going to be
gone. You might as well give it up. Okay.
So if you are a positive person and you believe that, you know, the systems you've got in the, you know, the democratic institutions we've got in the financial systems we've built over the last 50, 60, 70, 80 years, they're going to be there. People are going to be innovative and they're going to build new things and we're going to go to Mars or moon. If you believe in the future,
yes,
then you should at that time not worry about great companies. So yeah, if it is a good company, a great, you know, even better, a great company selling for a discount, buy it. If it is a company which has got company specific issues and therefore the share price has fallen 50%, don't buy it. At least that's what I do. I mean, you could do cigar butt investing and you think that there's something there, you know, turn around and so on, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about turn around something that has fallen because there's something wrong with the company or some specific company specific problem.
Right.
Those are much harder to get right. I'm just saying that, you know, once in a while,
market
overreaction is there.
Right.
At a smaller scale, we see that happen on, you know, with earnings and so on and so forth with companies. But those are always on a smaller scale. They're not like, you know, you don't get the 30%, 40% opportunities.
Very good. I'm going to give two examples as we go towards the close of the podcast. The first is Flight Centre, which fell from, I want to say, $35 to about $3 during the GFC.
Tell me how much it is now.
$60, give or take, among friends.
So if you bought at $3...
20 bagger or so. That's not bad, is it?
That is.
And again, for no good reason, right? This was the market. I mean, there are always reasons to worry. about any company at any point. But there was, it was both SARS and the internet were supposed to destroy Flight Centre's business. And again, a decade later, 20 bag is not bad. The other one is the best example I've ever had. I mean, there's only one Amazon, right? But Amazon went from a split adjusted price of $3 up to 90, and then all the way back to $9, lost 90% of its value. That $9 stock, now $1,500 a share.
$1,600.
That's an astonishing return, right? And so, again, you could have at any point between 90 and 9 said, the market's falling, share prices are falling, this is terrible, I'm getting out. And that would have been, kind of on the face of it, logical, right? Because who wants to lose money? The reality was, if you knew and saw the value of the company or the Flight Centre or Amazon, realized there was value there, were happy to basically let time do its thing and wait for the market to wake up, you had a lot of money as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Mate, you've almost stolen my entire high horse, I have to tell you, but because I can't help myself, I'm going to do it anyway.
Get on.
And it's... Again, we're lacking Liam, or we're lacking the horse. We're lacking the... There we go. Look, that was terrible, but thank you for making the effort.
Well, I tried. At least I tried.
You did. Yeah. I was, we haven't got the coconuts from Monty Python either. So I will mount the horse with a very quick one this time. And it kind of stems from that last point, mate. The investors are a funny breed. And we talk about long-term and short-term all the time, right? Here's the thing. If you buy shares, you are buying those shares because you think the market is wrong about the price, yes? You expect the price to go up over time, right? You're not buying them because they're already fully valued. You're buying because you think the future is going to be a higher price than it is now. Now, the problem is if the market already believed you, the price would already be higher. And so when people buy shares, they buy shares and then the share price falls. They say, oh, I bought those shares and the share price fell. It kind of should. Because if you're going to buy shares of a company that you think are mispriced, what you're really saying is the market is wrong about the value of this company. And so to all of a sudden expect, just because I buy shares this morning, that come Monday morning, the market's going to realize its mistake, realize how bright, smart, intelligent, good-looking I am, and all of a sudden re-rate the shares just because I bought them, it's kind of mad, right? So in some ways, you know, we know the market goes up 10% a year on average, and even though we know there's the occasional fall, we should expect, if we're buying individual stocks on the basis that the market is wrong, don't expect the market to come to your view all of a sudden straight away. It's the hardest thing for new investors to deal with because you buy shares for 100 bucks, they fall to 90 and you go, oh, this bloody share market thing is ridiculous. And you buy a second company at 50 and the shares go to 45 and you think, oh, I'm not cut out to do this. That's kind of what should happen, right? More often than not, if the market, say Flight Centre, at any point between 30 and 3, and then quite frankly, for a decent amount of time after that, stayed around those single-digit levels, it took a long time for the market to kind of come around and realize it was wrong. And during that time, it is testing. It is stressful. You are going to feel like you're wrong because the market, everyone else in the investing world is saying, you bought the shares that we think suck and the share price has fallen. And that is really, really hard to get used to. But if you can get anything into your heads as a result of this conversation, A, be long-term investors, and B, don't sweat the short-term. That's exactly what Doc was saying before about short-term negativity, even longer-term negativity. As long as the value of the company is really there and you can see something the market can't, that's exactly what you should be buying if you're trying to beat the market. In fact, if you want to beat the market, you have to do something different to the market by definition. That's exactly the recipe. That's exactly the formula. By the same token, by the way, if you're not up for that, buy an index. Yep. You'll do your 10% a year. You'll compound your money, add regularly. You'll be pretty rich, frankly, by the end of your life.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to pick stocks, and we think you should because we think you can do it well, just be prepared for that bad news, that pessimism, that gut-wrenching, oh God, I've made a horrible mistake. And if you do and you can see it through, I think you'll come out pretty well ahead.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what might some people, you know, think about 10% is pretty good, but, you know, 12% is even better.
Right. You compound that. Exactly.
And the difference is that 10% basically means your money doubles in 7 years.
Yep.
And 12% means your money doubles in 6 years. And you take that over a long period of time, that actually makes a big difference.
It does. Exactly. So very quick maths, over 42 years, you get an extra doubling if you're getting 12% rather than 10. So you put that forward. Let's say you double your money to $500,000 under one scenario. Under the other scenario, you get $1,000,000. It's a massive, massive, massive difference. On that exciting and bright note, mate, we should wrap this up, I reckon.
We should.
Our special mailbag edition. We hope you've enjoyed it. We hope next week, treats you well, or this week when you're listening. We won't be here, but we trust that the podcast will go to you and we trust that it will be enjoyable. As I said last week, if you do want to get in contact, please do. We love hearing your comments and questions, your feedback, your criticism if you have to, because this, we do this podcast for you. We like doing it. We enjoy it. We enjoy each other's company, but we're doing it because we're trying to spread a bit of foolishness a bit more broadly into the investing world. So please do get in touch at The Motley Fool AU, at Anirban Mahanti, or at TMF Scott P, all on Twitter, or send us an email at info@fool.com.au. Well, before you go, and if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big 5-star rating, preferably 4 if you must, if you're very cruel. But in this Uber age, 5 stars is the way to go.
Five. Definitely 5.
And it helps give us feedback. It also means that more people can find the podcast because the Android app and the Apple app do basically rank them on the basis of both the number of listeners and the ratings that people give it. So please give others a chance to find the podcast. We're sure they could use a little foolish straight talk too. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Until then, fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.